With Swap, we are focusing on one brick of DeFi, which is market making. So our purpose as a protocol is to enable any type of investor or market participant to benefit from the most advanced market making strategies. If you do everything on chain, you take a significant hit on the performances that you can. And also you take some hits in terms of flexibility of what you can do. That's actually one of the things that we learned with V1. Based on that, we decided to switch towards a model which is a bit different, in which we partially have the quotation system off chain. Now the brain behind the market making is done off chain, so we can have access to much faster data, which strongly improves the performance and enables us to go on Ethereum mainnet as part of our launch, for instance, which is a much bigger market than Polygon.
Swap version 2, which is due to be released shortly, is a non-custodial RFQ market making infrastructure. It provides optimal liquidity services with built-in defensive modules, or safeguards. LPs passively benefit from state-of-the-art market-making strategies originating from the stochastic control theory. Liquidity pools automatically compound fees, and are represented as ERC-20 tokens for simpler auditability and composability. So let us dive right in.
First of all, thanks for both of you being here, Louis and Cyril. I appreciate the opportunity to learn about Swap and how you two came together with the team to build this. The version 2 is coming up very soon. Louis, maybe you start with you. Your background is very interesting, being a researcher, but also being very practical. Our original conversation was around the Hitchhiker's Guide to DeFi that you put out. This is a must read for anybody who wants to get into DeFi. Maybe share a bit on the outset your research interests broadly, and then what led your path down the Swap route.
Sure, thank you. Thank you, Norbert, for this quick intro. My name is Robert Wushi. I'm a researcher in economics and finance. I work for a research institute in Paris. I started to dig into the blockchain space during my PhD 5 or 6 years ago now. And I got hooked up, I guess, since then. And I've been thinking and working almost entirely on this subject. Of course, I followed the arrival of the decentralized finance and the first DeFi protocols and so on. As you mentioned, with Ecole Polytechnique, we published a report, so like a general outlook for providing a broad overview of what decentralized finance is, what are the advantages, the drawbacks, the risks. Yeah, it was pretty much a broad overview of the space at that time. Of course, the DeFi space moves very fast. There are probably many updates, but we designed this report in a way that should be sufficiently general to remain valid and useful to people for some time, we believe. And then, so early 2022, I think, with a research team at Institut Louis Bachelier, we started working with Swap. Cyril will talk more about this. But we have deployed, let's say, state-of-the-art research in mathematical finance, something that we are very comfortable with at this research institute in Paris. We have many high-level researchers from this field involved in the institute. Most researchers, they don't completely and fully embrace DeFi as a whole, but we have to have more, and that's also something that I will be able to talk later about what we are currently doing at the Institut Louis Bachelier. There aren't some actual news, but I will be able to provide some insight on what we will do next year. Essentially, we built the team and we started to work with Cyril and his team to navigate the space of AMM and what it does, and then try to analyze and go a little bit further, in particular how to design something that would make a lot more sense from the liquidity provision side. With that, I don't know, maybe...
Hand it over to Cyril.
I'm Cyril Pastor. I'm the co-founder at Swap. My background is more traditional. I'm more on the business side at Swap, actually. My co-founder, David Abouba, is more focused on the tech and research aspect. I have a background in traditional finance. I did a business school in France, which is called HEC Paris, and graduated with a major in finance. And then I spent 4 years in strategy consulting at a company called BCG, where I focused mostly on projects in banks and asset management. So I have quite a wide view of the traditional financial sector. Then I decided that I wanted to do an entrepreneurial project. I wanted to build my own company. I joined a program which is called Entrepreneur First, which is a program which essentially helps founders that want to build companies to find a co-founder who has complementary skills and land on a project to be working together. So that's how I started to really deep dive into DeFi, and I met David, and that's how Swap was born. What drove me to DeFi are two things that I think are different from the traditional financial sector. I believe that DeFi is going to be the next infrastructure of the financial system because it's more composable, because it's more accessible, and it's more efficient. What I really like about DeFi is that it's like a complete blank slate and it's very open for innovation. Unlike traditional finance, which is, of course, much more established and regulated, which constrains innovation. The second aspect that I really like in DeFi is the culture, which I think is very open and fun. That's essentially what drove me to DeFi. With Swap, we are focusing on one brick of DeFi, which is market making. So our purpose as a protocol is to enable any type of investor or market participant to benefit from the most advanced market making strategies. What I call market participant can be either a retail investor looking for yields, an institutional investor as well, or a DAO, which is trying to improve liquidity on its token.
Wonderful. Thank you both for the introduction. For my early days in DeFi, let's say 2017, 18, two people in the garage really could build a DeFi project. And by now, there is deep academic research to push the frontiers further. You've got two founders matched an entrepreneur first from the business and the technical side, and they've got the institute in there, and you mix it all together, and then you get a great team. But does it feel to you as well the time of two people just spinning up a protocol is over because the frontiers have moved that much and it has in fact become really a mathematical finance problem that needs to be solved through deep research and then implementation?
I would say it depends primarily on the type of protocol, right? Of course, what we're trying to do with Swap is very heavy on the quant side, and that's why we're really happy to be partnering with Ashley Institute, with Louis, and also the other researchers working with us. For our specific case, indeed, we need deep expertise related to that. However, my general feeling is that it's still so early and there are still so many things that need to be built that I think that it's still possible to be two people in a garage building something that scales tremendously. One example of that is that there are many hackathons all over the world at each ETH conference. And we see very often projects that get big from a hackathon. So I think this is like the ultimate proof that this is possible. Also, DeFi is very scalable. Probably you can start just two people in a garage. And once you prove that there is really something that adds value to the ecosystem and that can bring a lot of value, funding comes afterwards and the scaling comes afterwards. So I would say it's still possible.
Thanks for mentioning the ETH events. We had ETH Global in Tokyo 2 months ago, maybe. I had an opportunity to also do a podcast with the winners there, and I think that was exactly the sentiment they shared as well, that over 2 days you can prove out an idea, and I think I agree with you on that part. Louis, on your side, I haven't done a PhD, so I ask a very naive question. PhD used to be maybe that thing where you go into the proverbial ivory tower and after 4 years you come out to document new thoughts. The pace of this space, DeFi, is so fast. How do you handle it as a researcher where you ultimately get measured or recognized for publication? How has that changed how people are doing research in this field?
When I first started to look into blockchain in general, and it was not even DeFi by then, it was, I think, during the year 2017. At that time, I was pretty much the only person at my university, all departments interested in the subject. Most people were actually trying to discourage me to work on this because at that time, everything was about Bitcoin and the hype around the cryptocurrency price. You had a lot of crypto anarchists that were trying to burn the financial system and so on. So it was really hard, and there were really a few papers on this subject, and the few papers that there were really general, trying to understand what the blockchain was, what it could be used for and so on. And then gradually, but over the course of the 2 or 3 last years, it exploded literally. We have been witness a very large number of researchers from every background, like computer science, economics, finance, law, I don't know your name, it's like really diverse backgrounds. And the number of working papers and also publications have increased exponentially. So it's hard to navigate, but there are pros and cons, right? It's a new field, so there are definitely a lot to still understand and a lot of research to do. And at the same time, everyone around the globe is trying to get a spot as a specialist, as an academic researcher in this field. So it also became very competitive. And maybe the last aspect I'd like to mention as we're speaking about research, in terms of publication, few papers make it right now to the top level journals, the general journal in finance, for instance. Very few papers, and most papers are published in topic-specific journals or DeFi-related journals. So that also means that we are still early, that still the space is not completely recognized by the broader financial community in terms of research, but the trend is definitely positive and more papers are published in those big peer-reviewed journals in finance. So I would say it's a very exciting field to work in. It's also very tiring because you have a lot of different papers all the time. So you need to be really focused to not miss something big.
It always feels like if you don't pay attention for a week, like a whole year of traditional finance has happened in the interim. Competition is good. I should bring out the best in all of it. At the same time, there was this paper from a zero regulator, right? The AMF. And they quoted 2,000 different DeFi protocols out there. So competition is good, but also surviving and making a dent is much harder. And congratulations for Swap. You raised $4.5 million in funding in this environment. That is not an easy task at all. It's a recognition of the credibility that the protocol has, obviously. So let's get to the heart of the matter. Cyril, you said it's one block. It's the automated market maker block. To level set everybody very briefly, what is an automated market maker? And then naturally, the second question, because you're also going from version 1 to version 2, what makes a good market maker and what are you doing in version 2 that you learned from version 1 and that's now better?
That's a lot of questions, actually. Maybe I will go even one step behind. The first question is, what is market making? The easiest example of market making that everybody in this chat has encountered is when you go to a foreign country and you need to trade a currency to be able to buy things in the country you're going to. If you had no market maker, you would have to find, let's say if you're going to the US, an American person that's willing to buy your local currency at the same price as you would like to sell and in the same quantity that you want at the same time. That's very inefficient and very annoying and very unlikely to happen as well. In order to cope for this problem and bring liquidity to a market, we have intermediaries, which are market makers, which hold both of the assets and enable anyone to trade an asset against another close to the market price immediately. So that's the role of a market maker. In fact, you have market makers on every financial market that's liquid. And they're more like funds that post orders on financial markets so that everyone can trade easily. And the way that those funds get revenue is through the commission that they charge, which is called the spread, which is the spread between the buy price and the sell price of an asset. Market makers are really critical to the liquidity of a market. They're essential for financial markets. There are also funds in which you can provide deposits, assets, in order to make a yield. In crypto today, you have two types of market makers. You have what is called the centralized market makers, which are players that are actually very similar to the players in traditional finance. And you have players which are called automated market makers, which are protocols deployed on the blockchain that do this in a programmatic and a decentralized way. If we look at how traditional centralized market makers operate, so names include, for instance, in crypto, you have Wintermute, you have Jump Trading, but you also have quite infamous names like Alameda, which was the market maker of FTX, Three Arrows Capital, which is a fund that blew up in 2022. Or even in TradFi, you have also infamous players like Bernard Madoff, who was a market maker previously. Traditional market makers, they face a couple of issues. The first thing is they're not accessible to anyone as financial products. If you're an LP, you need to be able to provide a very sizable check and to be well connected if you want to be able to benefit from the rewards of such market making strategies.
The second problem that they have is that they're not transparent. It's not possible to audit the way that a market maker makes his yield. To give you an example, Madoff, it was not possible to see how he was making the 12% that he promised to his LPs. And if we had been able to audit that, we would have seen that, in fact, he was not really making 12%, but he was actually taking those 12% from the inflows of new entrants. Another example of that, obviously, is Alameda, who was playing with the funds of the customers of FTX, Three Arrows Capital, which was taking much more risks than disclosed to its LPs. They were leveraging on Luna, for instance, and taking sizable positions. A third problem that traditional market makers have is that they are custodians. If anything happens to the market maker, you cannot get your funds back easily. A good example of that is Alameda, who was a designated market maker for a lot of projects in the Solana ecosystem. Those projects, they lent tokens to Alameda so that they could market make effectively. The issue is that many of those projects, when Alameda failed, they started to sell some of these tokens, which didn't belong to them because they were just borrowed. And now that Alameda is under Chapter 11, well, those tokens are locked, which is a problem for those projects. The last issue with traditional market makers is more like a missed opportunity. They don't benefit from what I believe is one of the killer features of DeFi, which is the interoperability. What one needs to understand is that in DeFi, you can actually use your capital at several places, which really maximizes the efficiency of financial products. You can do that because everything is super transparent. It's very easy to assess the exact risks that you're taking, for instance. When you deposit assets within a market maker, you cannot do that for those same transparency reasons. So now switching back to automated market makers. As I said, automated market makers are protocols that are deployed on the blockchain and that fill this actual market making service on the blockchain directly. How do they work? The principle is that you have people who deposit liquidity. You can do that from any amount. You can deposit your capital and you can remove it at any time. The capital that is deposited into those pools is used to do market making according to a mathematic formula, which is generally the constant product formula. That's the mechanism which is used to price how the assets are sold to traders who want to benefit from the liquidity service. Automated market makers actually solve all of the problems that I just mentioned around centralized actors. They are accessible to anyone, anytime, from any place in the world. They are non-custodial. You're the only one who has access to your money. They are super transparent on the way they operate and they are interoperable. But they have one major issue, actually. They are just not profitable for liquidity providers. On average, actually, people who provide liquidity on what is called uncorrelated asset pairs, for instance, a pair which would be like Ethereum to USDC, on average, the returns are negative with a super high variability. So when you're providing liquidity into an AM, you are closer to being a casino player than an investor. You have chances to win a lot of money, but you have even higher chances to lose a lot of money. So you're essentially playing the roulette. What we do at Swap is that we try to bring the best of both worlds. We try to be open, interoperable, transparent, and non-custodial like an automated market maker, but with performances that are comparable to centralized actors. The way we do that compared to automated market makers is that first we rely on the best math around market making that there is out there. And that's the whole point of our collaboration with the Weebashley Institute. So really the idea is to bring the best models that exist in traditional finance and which have been existing for 50 years to adapt them to the infrastructural specificities of DeFi. The second aspect in which we differentiate is also we use external information in our pricing design. So that may be a bit more technical, but AMMs like Uniswap are actually completely blind to the outside world. So they're absorbing a lot of what is called toxic flow, which are traders that are more informed than they are and which capture value from the people that supply liquidity into the platform. That was a bit long, but I wanted to dive back on the premise of why we do that and what's the current state of the market.
Thank you, Cyril. That was in the AMF document that came out this week. They described this constant product formula, the automated market making on protocols like Uniswap as high risk negative return, which is probably not something you want to use as a marketing slogan. As you said, you're improving on that. There's always any discussion around on-chain, off-chain. How do you break down what you're doing with Swap? What are the components and what of that actually then happens on-chain and what happens off-chain?
At Swap, we have an approach which tries to maximize performance and security. What one needs to understand is that when you go fully on-chain, you get a lot of benefits in terms of performance, etc. And security, if you don't get hacked, obviously, but I think this is something that's going to get settled in the medium term. Being on-chain has those virtues. But today, the blockchains are very slow. So it's impossible to be competitive compared to platforms that are centralized, like Binance, Coinbase, or whatever. If you do everything on-chain, you take a significant hit on the performances that you can do. And also, you take some hits in terms of flexibility of what you can do, so the assets that you can market make, the chains on which you can deploy. That's actually one of the things that we learned with V1. V1 is a product that is fully on-chain from the liquidity vaults where you deposit your assets to market make and benefit from the yield. The trade settlement, which is when a trader wants to make a swap, actually performing the settlement of the swap. And the quotation system, which is the brain behind the market making. Everything is fully on-chain and we use, for instance, oracles. So you can think of oracles as APIs that stream data on-chain. And that is what we use to understand what are the prices on other venues. But the main issue that we were facing with on-chain is that the oracles are actually too slow on the blockchain. So we were constrained in terms of chains where we could deploy and assets that we can actually market make. And also the level of risk that the model can take, because the more risk you take with a laggy oracle, the more dangerous it gets. Based on that, we decided to switch towards a model which is a bit different, in which we partially have the quotation system off-chain. Now the brain behind the market making is done off-chain, so we can have access to much faster data, which strongly improves the performance and enables us to go on Ethereum mainnet as part of our launch, for instance, which is a much bigger market than Polygon. This new design, we don't make any compromise in terms of security, because what we implement are on-chain safeguards, which verify that the quotes that are sent off-chain verify some conditions, so that this functioning of the off-chain part could not impact the performances of the liquidity providers by more than a certain threshold. We have implemented a kind of on-chain max drawdown, which reduces the exposure of LPs to a problem or a hack or just a misperformance of the off-chain module by more than X percent, and X being a parameter of the model. We wanted to do something that's pragmatic and that enables us to have a flexible architecture that maximizes the performance on the LP side, while keeping it trustless so that this design could be integrated into other protocols and benefit from the properties of DeFi.
So we're talking a quotation model, we're not talking an order book. So you're, as the market maker, you're putting out buy and sell quotes, and then the counterparty can choose to execute against those. That's the spread that the market maker should earn. If you do this in traditional finance and you're a licensed market maker, then you have certain obligations of providing these quotes within a certain range. The safety net that you described of the maximum drawdown, does that address some latency as well from hitting the quotation, doing a trade at that point, and then the time it takes to have this represented on-chain, because then the transition needs to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the twist is that when you want to do a trade, so usually the trades that are done on Swap, they actually are routed from aggregators. We really see ourselves as a market-making layer. We don't see ourselves as an exchange layer. This kind of model is actually called an RFQ model, so request for quotes. It's not like an order book model, where you post orders and you can sell them as a market maker in traditional markets. The way that this works is that, so we get quotes, right? We put quotes. When an aggregator decides to route a trade to us, the quote is given on-chain, but it's called from the smart contracts, and it's verified on-chain in the same transaction. So it gets compared against oracle values that are on-chain. And then there's this max drawdown, which is computed to ensure that the quote stays in the limits that are defined by the smart contracts. It doesn't trigger any latency issues besides the existing infrastructural constraints that exist with DeFi. It's not slower than any other AMM protocols.
And then in terms of the parameters, this maximum drawdown, is that at the level of each liquidity pool or is it for the protocol as a whole? And if the latter, so what's the governance around that?
The idea behind that is to be able to customize to the needs of each type of LP and type of pools, right? It's more at the pool level. It can be decided by the governance of the protocol. This will be progressively decentralized. Those are immutable parameters. They cannot be changed easily.
If I was a liquidity provider, could I run two different pools with two different thresholds to see how they react under distress scenarios, for example?
The pools need to be supported by the quotes provider, which is off-chain. It's not possible to open any pool anytime like that. But we plan to open more and more pools as the protocol develops. In the protocol, it's very easy to assess the risk that you are doing. Those on-chain parameters, you can see them on-chain and they're immutable, right? It's not possible to circumvent that. Those are more really safety measures for extreme scenarios. But apart from that, it's very easy to assess the yield that is made by the protocol because all the transactions happen on-chain. You can monitor, and like if you were an LP into a traditional market maker, you can monitor essentially the level of risk that you're taking by assessing the volatility of the returns, for instance, and the extreme values around that and the average return of the yield.
In the white paper, it said the first strategy to be implemented is HODL. That doesn't necessarily prevent you or exclude the possibility that you have a negative return. It's just that you get the same return or better as if you were holding through your market making activity.
The problem that Cyril described on the traditional AMMs and when he said that the profit was negative was with respect to the HODL strategy. Because if you have an asset that increases in value a lot, you may end up having more than when you started. But the point is that with traditional AMM, you will have less than if you did not provide liquidity in the first place. So this is the first and the most natural strategy that seems to be implemented. It's the performance through HODL. You're measuring, and this is also one of the specifics here, you're measuring the performance of your pool in terms of that, in terms of how you deviate from the HODL strategy. And of course, you also collect transaction fees along the route.
It's a financial product in the end, so there are no guarantee whatsoever. But the objective of the strategy is to outperform the HODL strategy.
You're killing at least two birds with one stone. One is to say that there are certain aspects on doing things on chain that are just too slow and that need to be moved off chain. And at the same time, the aspect that is off chain is actually all the TradFi logic that becomes now much easier implementable, because presumably the adjustment that is required is less if you do this off-chain. Maybe the third one is that if you actually change the algorithms, then you don't need to change the protocol because the quotation system is off-chain. That really creates a very accessible environment for anybody who had some, as you said, like the 50 years of TradFi experience dealing with market-making activity should be easily be enabled to be a participant on the swap protocol.
What swap does is to put the emphasis on the liquidity providers, because those are the people that have been left out from the early design of AMMs. Early design of AMMs works great for traders. If you can be really fast at identifying arbitrage opportunities in the market of Uniswap, for instance, and if you're careful also in terms of your order of the transaction in the block and so on, without getting too technical here, but it allows for traders to make a lot of money, to do a lot of arbitrage, and that's actually what a lot of people do. Swap put the emphasis on the liquidity provider side and allow them to benefit from state-of-the-art strategy. In that sense, it's a lot closer in terms of the naming also to what would be an automated market maker, in the sense that it's closer to human market maker working on a desk in a bank in TradFi, but completely autonomous.
How do you compare the speeds? We said taking the quotation system off-chain makes it really fast. How fast do you quote? How many quotes per second or whatever the measure might be is feasible today as state of the art in the system?
We're still not at the level that it happens in the traditional financial markets, but we're getting much closer. I would rather compare with the previous implementations. In the V1, we are using the oracles that are on Polygon. The oracles on Polygon, they stream approximately every 27 seconds, which is a very big amount of time if you compare that to TradFi. But which is actually super fast if you compare to Ethereum on the Ethereum network, oracles, which are like the price information from Binance, Coinbase, etc., they stream the update every half an hour or every deviation by more than 0.5% of their value. That's a huge discrepancy. By moving this quotation system off-chain, we're able to get those off-chain data feeds. We get information approximately every 250 milliseconds. So that's already a 100x increase. And it also allows us to deploy on Ethereum, which was not possible with the previous design. So we're getting much closer to TradFi like speed in terms of information and quotes. But then I would say in TradFi, they've been investing millions of dollars and fighting on this for many years. We're still not exactly at the same level. And also then in terms of execution, when you're on-chain, it's a totally different game, right? Because these transactions need to be processed into the blocks. You're still constrained in terms of actual settlement of the trade by the validation of the transaction on-chain.
In any case, you will not be able to go faster than the block time that the blockchain you're using, unless you move to layer two. That's another story. Also, when I was talking about the speed of computation, it's really comparing this as more like traditional RFQ systems instead of order books. And in an RFQ system, if you want to buy, I don't know, 100 million of US dollars against euros, like in the TradFi, you will probably call someone, sales, and you will request a price for the euro dollar. He will do some computation on his own and tell you what the offer price would be, and something that will not be feasible to compute on-chain because it will consume so much gas. The models employed, when we say state-of-the-art, they involve deep mathematical modeling and deep numerical solutions that cost essentially nothing. They can run on a fast computer in seconds or in milliseconds, but that would be completely impractical on the blockchain itself.
Luis, wanted to get back to your future research agenda. You were talking about this on the outset. What is in the plan for the institute?
The Rubashiri Institute is a research institute. At the beginning, it was still focused on traditional finance in the sense that it was built right after the financial crisis of 2008 with the aim of providing state-of-the-art research to the financial system to try to prevent this kind of crisis from happening again. We are now in the process of pushing a lot toward the decentralized finance industry and ecosystem with the same objectives in mind. There had been a bunch of crises in DeFi, but not like huge systemic ones. But still, the goal would be there are many protocols, ideas around. So here we're talking about swapping assets and market making, but you have also lending, you have stable coins, you have a lot of very diverse protocols and aspects to DeFi. On the other hand, you have also a lot of researchers, top level researchers in mathematics, finance, economics, that are yet to have been interested in those subjects. And so we plan to fill that gap in a sense to get more people, more researchers involved in the DeFi space, and in the end, support the DeFi ecosystem to bring more credibility to it. We believe that the DeFi revolution has already started and it's not going to stop anytime soon. And we should care, really, we should care. And traditional financial institutions should also care. And the regulators should also care. That we have seen that they started to really dive deep into it, at least on the French side. Two recent documents from two of the traditional regulators that are tackling those issues. We want to support these initiatives even further. We will have more news towards the end of this year, so maybe there will be an opportunity to talk again on that.
Super, thank you. We have avoided talk about regulation here in this hour. This was really fantastic deep dive into the mechanics. And to conclude, Cyril, just a brief status as to where we are in release, call to action for people, where can they sign up in terms of trying things out, and when do you go live with the mainnet, these type of things?
We're going live in a few weeks now. Very excited about that. If you want to be able to try the products, our launch is going to happen in two waves. We're going to have a whitelist. People who are whitelisted will be able to have an early access to the product and enjoy exclusive benefits. That's the first part. So if you want to be whitelisted, you can participate to the whitelist campaign on Zili. More information are on our website. Then we have a public launch. So if you want to sign up for that, just stay tuned. Look at our communication on socials and or on LinkedIn as well. You can follow me or ask me as a connection on LinkedIn. and we'll open the vaults for liquidity and deposits at this stage.
Super. I think that was an awesome conversation. I realized there were aspects that I personally would have liked to dive deeper in, more on composability and what can be built on top. But maybe that's an opportunity to loop back, as Louis suggested as well, in a few months. We'll all watch the launch. And once we've got the first experiences under the belt, then it'll be fantastic to loop back. Gentlemen, really appreciate you taking the time. I really appreciate it. And have a good rest of your week.
Thank you very much, Norbert, for having us.